The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
How is the volume? If I speak like this, is this okay? Okay, great. Thank you. So there was once a cave meditator who wanted to practice, you know, by himself up in seclusion in some mountains. And he finally got together the conditions to be able to do that. He had some benefactors who were supporting him by having food and other supplies dropped off at some place nearby that he could get to, so he didn't have to go the several days to get back to the village that was nearby. So he had support, and in his little cave, he had a nice altar set up, you know, with a Buddha image and some other sacred items, and he would make, you know, he would light incense and make offerings every day, and he would practice very diligently in the cave. And he did that for some years and found it deeply beneficial, was often grateful to the benefactors supporting him. And then one day he heard that they were going to come visit him in his cave. And his response at first was to spruce everything up and, you know, sweep it out really well and clean off the altar and make it so beautiful so that for them when they came. And then this thought came into his mind, what am I doing? And, you know, I've been meditating to let go of the ego and the self and all of this, and here I am putting on a show. And so he picked up a handful of dirt and he threw it on the altar. And later he said, he was recalling that time, and he said that that was the finest offering he made on the whole retreat. So the topic for today is reverence and irreverence. And it may be that one or the other of those is very meaningful to you, and you've practiced it or you consider it part of your life. Or maybe they're not so clear. Maybe that's not, don't feel as relevant to you. But the suggestion for today is that both are important ingredients in our practice and on our path, and it's worth getting to know both reverence and irreverence. So we may see ourselves as definitely having one of those and not the other. That can be a sort of a common pattern. But reverence and irreverence are actually just both practices that we can do. And as such, each one can be done skillfully or unskillfully. Each one of those can be done skillfully or unskillfully. And we probably sometimes need each of them in their skillful form along our path. And if this idea of reverence and irreverence isn't something that you think about very much, or maybe something that you kind of avoid thinking about, then this talk might be even especially relevant for you. So we can start by asking, you know, what is reverence? What are we talking about? And I would say it's a range or a spectrum. And on a basic level, it means taking something seriously. Early in my practice, I was talking with someone who had practiced much longer than me. And he was a person who often spoke very directly. That was a little bit his character. And he said to me, Kim, you know, you don't take yourself very seriously. And he meant that in a particular way. He meant that I wasn't taking so seriously my spiritual longing or my interest in the Dharma, my path, my deepest aspirations. You know, early in my practice, I didn't quite know how to relate to that. I didn't feel up to that. I felt, but from my background, I didn't have maybe the qualities to be able to take that seriously and bring that forth in myself. That came later. And so I felt maybe a little uncomfortable about acknowledging how much I cared about the practice, how much I cared about the Dharma, and how I might even have awakening as an aim. I wasn't really ready to say that. And he picked that right out. I'm grateful for that. And when I reflect back on this older friend, I realize that he's one of the most reverent and the most irreverent people that I know. He has both of those very well developed, and it's admirable. It's admirable. So the spectrum of reverence starts with taking something seriously, and it extends out to even feeling awe or wonder, being willing to devote one's heart or one's life to something that feels valuable, meaningful. So there's a real strength, you know, there can be a real strength to this quality of reverence. But at times, maybe even often, our reverence can get a little bit misdirected. There is, as I said before, there's skillful and unskillful reverence and irreverence. So there's four combinations, and I want to talk about all four of them so we get kind of a map of this space. And they're not merely opposites. There are four distinct things to talk about. So these four quadrants, and we'll start with the quadrant of unskillful reverence, actually. Cases where our reverence is somewhat misdirected, if we even have it. So what is it that we're taking seriously in our life? What is that? Are there things in our life or our mind or our heart that we are in some way paying homage to that maybe don't deserve that level of devotion? I want to read a couple of lines from a verse, and then we'll talk through what it means. This is from the 37 Practices of the Bodhisattva. Locked up in the prison of their own patterning, whom can ordinary gods protect? So it's a little bit poetic. It's talking about the ordinary things in life that we place our trust in. So pleasure, you know, the things that we like and enjoy. Maybe wealth. Maybe power. Maybe health and fitness. You know, our body is feeling good right now. Our relationships. Learning. Physical safety, ethical purity, even meditative bliss or meditative enjoyment. Now, many of these things are good. That's where it gets entangled, confusing. These are good things that are worth having in a human life, all of them, actually. But they become problematic when they rise to the level of being revered, don't they? Yeah, so that is when things become gods. They're ordinary gods. They're just ordinary things, but we can make them into gods in some way. And if we do that, what we're doing is buying into the worldview or the psychological pattern that they uphold, and we're trying to use that to protect us. You know, if I just had enough money, then I would be safe. That's a worldview. It's not that we shouldn't have any money, but that worldview is dangerous to buy into. Or, you know, my physical health is who I am. Very dangerous to buy into. So we've done this maybe in some ways. And the problem is that all of these things are transient. They're not true protection, and they're not really totally in our control, are they? So there's always a little bit of stress if we've made these into gods. So these are the ordinary gods that most of the world reveres at some level. So ordinary gods can also be more subtle. They can be psychological patterns in our mind or our mental habits. You know, for example, we also get stuck in various views and opinions and ways of perceiving things. We may be very attached to our political perspective or some ways of seeing the world. And sometimes we're not even aware that that's it. That's what we've done. But meditation will eventually, if you do mindfulness meditation, you'll eventually see some of these patterns in the mind. We can also get stuck in stories about our life, stories about how we got to here, stories about who we are, stories about what we're doing. And again, these are things where we wouldn't want to have none of that. We have some sense of who we are and our life and so forth. But again, these things are so easy to get hooked into. And they shouldn't really be taken so seriously that they're made the foundation of our well-being. It can be humbling when we realize what we have allowed our heart to get entangled with. And there are many people who come to meditation practice and to Buddhism because there has been some kind of a shocking event in their life that revealed that these gods were only ordinary and were not protecting them. Loss of a job, death of a loved one, a change in our health. Maybe some of these things resonate for some of you in this room as to why practice became meaningful to you. It's not always like that, but they can jolt us into seeing our misplaced reverence. So they have a way of bringing into focus what's really important for us. So let's shift then toward the quadrants that are associated with irreverence. So they're not just quite opposite. Each quadrant is distinct, not just a negation of the others. So, you know, if we decide that we're not going to revere bodily health and financial success and those kinds of things, learning, education, that's one for me that I find valuable. It's not that we would turn around and reject these things, say, all right, none of this matters. It's not about nihilism or that kind of cynicism. So we've looked at unskillful reverence. Let's turn to what skillful irreverence is. A little bit the opposite. So Dharma practice, and especially mindfulness practice, helps us to see through things that that we might have been stuck with. If we continue with the practice, we have to see more and more. It's just how it works. The mind gets drawn to seeing because that's what we're practicing. We're practicing paying attention in the moment to what's going on in the body, in the mind, in the heart, in the emotions. And eventually, if we continue to take data in that way, if you will, moment to moment to moment, we watch what's going on, the mind is going to start to see patterns in that. And mindfulness has a way of breaking things open or differentiating experience so that we see different aspects of it, different parts of it, not be fooled by the solid-seeming nature of it that we saw at the beginning. So one term that's used for this in the practice is disenchantment, nibbida in Pali. But it's not a bad kind of disenchantment, a negative kind, like that word sometimes has that implication in English. But it actually means that we're no longer charmed or enchanted, as if a spell had been cast on us. It's a minor form of waking up to see through things and realize, oh, wow, I was really caught up in that. So it's a positive term. And once we have some experience with seeing through things, like just as an example, it's fairly common for people to come on retreat, spend a few days like meditating, so a little bit more immersive than usually at home, and realize in that time that they view everything through a certain lens, like maybe the lens of fear. It's fairly common for people to say, well, I had no idea that this was underlying so much of my life. And that, you know, that's like it's a seeing through. It's a moment of no longer being in the spell, caught under the spell of the fear, but you wake up to it, you see it. Doesn't mean it's over, but seeing it is so important, that moment. And once we have some experience with seeing through in certain ways, then we gain the ability to be skillfully irreverent of some of the mind's tricks, some of the mind's patterns, and also some of the cultural patterns that are out there in the world. Jack Kornfield says that he was going through a period of seeing a lot of patterns in his mind, and he started naming the different ones that he found, like, you know, he had a certain voice in his mind that was critical of everything he did. You know, oh, you're probably going to mess that one up too. And, you know, he couldn't necessarily stop that voice from coming. We don't necessarily get a choice about that. But when it would come, he would bow to it. He had a name for it. And he would say, thank you for your opinion and move on, you know. So there was a way that he could lighten up a little bit, be a little bit irreverent toward that voice because it wasn't helping him. So I also think about Sylvia Boorstein has a nice little set of phrases that she says that are useful, words that are useful for how to practice. She says we should practice with gentleness, precision, and humor. And I think that the order is important, but the humor part, you know, she says you have to just sometimes laugh at what the mind comes up with. It's like, wow, where did that come from? You know, where did that thought come from? Where did that idea come from? So it's very freeing to be able to smile a little bit at the antics of the mind, at least sometimes. I know we can't do it all the time. We're still practicing. We're still getting caught up. But when we have those moments, to be able to be skillfully irreverent of some of what the mind comes up with, just based on habit. And then this can extend even into some of the conventional norms out in society. We see that they're just conventions. And again, it's not that we wouldn't have ways of doing things in society, but it's nice if we can see through those a little bit. There's a fellow who drives around Santa Cruz in a sort of a custom camper kind of thing, very large actually. And it's painted in his, you know, clearly his own artwork. It says, you know, peace and freedom in big letters on it. And it has streamers and decorations. You can't miss this thing when it's driving around. And, you know, it's all done in kind of a humorous and yet serious way of poking a little bit of fun at people just going about their conventional lives. You know, he has this way that wakes people up a little bit with his tricked out camper, let's say. It can even extend into the spiritual or religious realm. You know, I think about how the Dalai Lama laughs at the pomp associated with his position. I mean, he takes his position seriously. You know, he acts as the bodhisattva of compassion for our world. But, you know, the price of that, in a sense, is that when he comes places, there's gold brocade and these fancy things, and people are always attending to him. And he has a way of very gently showing that he sees through that. you know, he's going to go and sit on the throne. But I remember watching a video of him where they had some very high seat for him to sit on to give a teaching, and it was very beautiful. And, you know, he came and he did his bows and he got up on the seat, and he noticed that it had been padded. It was very soft for him, and he realized it was a little bit bouncy, and he paused and he bounced on it, you know, just for a moment, and then he went back. But you could see him like, oh, look at that, bouncing. I bounced when I was 5 years old on a chair. But you know, so he takes his position lightly in a skillful way. This is skillful irreverence of seeing through things, certain lightness of being. There's a prayer in Vajrayana practice where one asks, give me energy to see through life's illusions. Wouldn't that be nice if we could always see through life's illusions beforehand? Yeah. So, here in the United States, I would say that we have a culture of celebrating certain types of irreverence. It's a little bit in our nature that we have that quality somehow. But we can pay a price for that in sometimes sliding in, let's say, to the quadrant that we could call unskillful irreverence. Okay, so we talked about skillful irreverence, but we can go too far. Often we can be cynical, we can have sarcasm about our approach to life. My father says that perhaps when he was in his 20s. He was once told around that time by an older mentor that he was not quite mature yet because he still sometimes used sarcasm. And he never forgot that, to be told by, you know, this older guy that he wasn't quite mature yet. He was thinking he was hot stuff being a 20-something guy. And he realized over time, yeah, sarcasm doesn't always serve.
Do you think it would harm people's physical safety if you use sarcasm?
People hold the questions until after the Dharma talk.
Oh, I apologize.
It's okay, thank you. I'll be happy to address that if it's still a question at the end. Other aspects of unskillful irreverence include that we don't often take some elements of spirituality seriously. So devotion, prayer. Here in the West, the Western version of Buddhism, those were actually deliberately stripped out when they were brought here because the teachers thought that Westerners wouldn't like that sort of thing. Might be true, but if you go to Asia, people are so devoted many times, at least in the places that I've been and seen there. There's a lot of devotion. There is even the acceptance of using prayer. And it's there's a lot of heartfulness, and you can feel it in the energy of the temples there. And there can be a way that we don't honor that quite in our version here. Sometimes we also feel too irreverent to be willing to surrender in our practice. This practice ultimately asks us to give up quite a lot. And, you know, renouncing aspects of our attachment to self, renouncing some of what we thought was so important earlier in life, those ordinary gods. If we have too much irreverence, too much, there's even some ego sometimes in irreverence, we may not be willing to give up what this practice asks us to let go of to be truly free. So we might be irreverent toward things that are really quite beautiful if we were willing to open to them. And that can leave a hole in the heart. it doesn't allow our heart to be completely filled by our practice. Something would be lacking in our spirituality, some juice not quite there, if we're not willing to touch into the heart dimension, the letting go, the giving up, the surrender. There are times, every few years, I don't know if we've done it for a while, but every few years here, we have a refuge ceremony. Probably it didn't happen during the pandemic, but it's a time when people who want to, who are interested to do so can come and formally take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And there's a little ceremony that Gil does with that. And I was not too keen on this idea. I did this ceremony, I think, in 2008, something like that. And I wasn't too keen on it, but I was getting more involved in IMC and felt like I had joined the board at that time. And I felt like somehow it felt right. And so there's a little class, you take a few sessions, and then there's a ceremony at the end. And I kind of thought in my mind, well, okay, I'll do this thing, it's a thing to do here at the center. And I don't think I was, disrespectfully irreverent, but nonetheless, I was taken by complete surprise that I was deeply moved by the simple act. When it was made formal and the lights were dark and we lit candles and offered flowers and then sat in meditation and took the refuges and precepts officially, that I just, my body just felt light. It was flooded with this spiritual quality called piti, joy. And it was probably better, I think, that I had no clue that I was capable of that kind of feeling, because it took me by surprise, and it was so delightful. It opened something in me. Yeah, probably better that it was a surprise. So, the remedy, if you will, for unskillful irreverence, where we've gotten a little bit into that sarcasm, ego, I'm not going to let go, is to open to healthy, skillful reverence. Some people move toward this kicking and screaming, and others discover it. Others have it naturally, which is nice. But that's the last of our four quadrants. We're now moving to skillful reverence. So we had skillful and unskillful reverence and irreverence. So let's get to skillful reverence. So one basic form is refuge, as I talked about with the ceremony. So refuge in the triple gem, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And when we started back four quadrants ago in the quadrant of unskillful reverence, I read two lines from a verse about the ordinary gods. And I want to read you the whole four-line stanza now, the whole four-line verse. Locked up in the prison of their own patterning, whom can ordinary gods protect? Who can you count on for refuge? Go for refuge in the three jewels. This is the practice of a bodhisattva, or we could say this is the practice of a sincere practitioner. So we can start out doing this at, kind of a surface level, but then we'll find that it unfolds over time. We have to unfold it more and more. Maybe we just say the words at first. Like if you go to a retreat, for example, often on the first evening, everybody is invited to take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha and say the five precepts as a creation of the container, the community container there. And if you've never done that and it's a little bit of a surprise when it's happening, you might just say the words and move on. But then eventually there's a way that they can start to work on us. Recalling my experience with the ceremony, I had said the refuges before that, but suddenly it came alive when I did it at the ceremony. So they woke me up to looking more carefully at refuge. So skillful reverence includes taking seriously the beauty of our own heart. Everybody's heart has beauty in it. Even just for wanting to do the practice or for starting to practice mindfulness, there's beauty right there. But there's also so many ways in which we are living ethically, ways in which we're offering metta or gratitude or care to people, to the world, to animals. Everybody has something. And perhaps we have something deeper. Perhaps we have a spiritual longing that's bringing us to practice in some way. There's a word for this in Pali, a samvega, a sense of spiritual longing. Gill tells a story of a man who came to a temple, and he was not too sure about practice, but somehow he was drawn to coming to the temple, and he saw a statue outside the doors, maybe, and he sat and looked at it for a while, and he was sort of debating, you know, should I really open to practice? I don't know. And this was a statue that had some magical qualities through the power of this temple. And it said to him, "Why not?" And he was very shocked. and the statue just said again, "Why not?" And the man was so scared, he ran away. Have we done that? Why not? Why not? So, you know, don't dismiss those deeper feelings in your heart. You don't have to speak them, you don't have to share them, but at least for yourself, please open to them at some level. Don't brush them under the rug. There's a sutta where it's actually about a dream that somebody has, but it's a very mythological and allegorical dream, if you will. And in the dream, he has a series of choices. You know, like he's digging and he finds things along the way. And he's digging and he finds a fork. And the advice that he's given is throw out the fork and keep digging. So he throws out the fork and he keeps digging and he finds all these things. I don't remember all of them. One of them's like a chopping block with a piece of meat on it. And it says, throw out the chopping block and keep digging with the knife. And so he keeps digging. And eventually, after eight or nine things, he finds a Naga serpent, which is a powerful, mythical beast in Buddhism, generally benign, meant to represent great power that can come from practice, or even big things in general are just called Nagas, like elephants are called Nagas, and sometimes arahants, awakened beings, are called Nagas. So he finds a Naga serpent, and then the advice is stop digging, honor the Naga serpent. And the sense is that we keep digging and digging in our heart, in our life, in our practice, in our path. And we keep finding things where we have choices and we let go of the things that are not useful. You know, the fork is doubt. Don't need that. The chopping block, sensual pleasure. We don't need that. We don't need to pursue that, make it a god. Eventually we find something very beautiful, a Naga serpent in the heart. Don't throw that one out. Honor that one. There's also a sutta about the monastic sangha, but we could just think of it as a spiritual community where there's a new monk who is, you know, they have so many rules for monks to follow, you know, like over 200 little rules that they have to, some of them are big, some of them are little, that they have to follow as they go through their day, their life. And there's a new monk who is continually making mistakes on the rules. And, you know, you're supposed to in some way admonish a monk who is not fulfilling the rules so that he can benefit from them. But there's a sutta where the other monks sense that this monk who keeps having trouble with the rules is actually just proceeding from very deep love and faith of the Buddha, and that's filled his heart, and that's why he ordained, and that's all he cares about, and he can't get the details, but he has this love and this faith. And when they see that, they decide not to admonish him right away because they worry that that will dampen his faith, actually, and it would be more unbeneficial for him to have that happen than to, you know, keep going. And eventually he sort of grows into being able to manage the rules. But it's so compassionate, right, that they saw his love and his faith and they, you know, let him find his way. So we might consider that for ourselves also as we move along with this practice. Skillful reverence for our effort, our best effort that we're bringing. So in light of all this, we could say, I think it's fair to say, that spiritual maturity includes skillful, healthy reverence of some type. Do you dare? So we have to discover, I think, for ourselves what this is. We can't borrow it from someone else or imitate it. And I would say that it even matters in secular ways also, you know, out in society. There's a way in which we've lost touch with being reverential and daring to acknowledge what is worthy of reverence out in the regular conventional world. And that may have something to do with the challenges we're seeing in our society and in our world. We may not take seriously things that are worth taking seriously. Even the Buddha felt moved to express reverence. He's the Buddha, right? But there's a sutta, a discourse where it's, I think, soon after the Buddha's awakening. And he says, this is what the line is, he says, "It is painful to dwell without reverence and deference." The Buddha says this. And the word translated as reverence is garavo, which is probably most closely resembles our idea of respect. So the Buddha was looking around for something to respect. He had just woken up, and he couldn't find any being in the world who was his superior in terms of ethics, in terms of meditation, in terms of wisdom, in terms of liberation. And yet, he still wanted to offer something. You know, those waking up didn't take away that wish in his heart. And so what he decided to do was he said that he could still feel reverence and deference to the Dharma. Isn't that sweet? And, you know, this was before he had done a lot of teaching, so I don't think he's referring to all of the stuff he said, because he hadn't said it yet. I think what he was referring to is Dharma as nature, you know, Dharma as the way things work, the order, the way things unfold, which he awoke to completely in waking up. He saw how it all works, and that he could offer reverence to the beauty of the universe. I find it quite touching that the Buddha still wanted to dwell in reverence and deference. So I would think surely it's appropriate for us also. So I look for this in people as they practice. You know, does it seem that they've found something that's worth taking seriously or feeling awe for? I look for that as people practice over time. Have they discovered something worthy of reverence? What have you found? Just reflect for a moment. What have you found that might be worthy of that? So there's an important change in people when they shift from wondering how the Dharma can fit into their life to wondering how their life can fit into the Dharma. It's a shift. Spiritual maturity might also include healthy irreverence, a certain lightness of being, bouncing on the seat like the Dalai Lama, you know? So we don't want to take ourselves too seriously in all of that. There should be a little irreverence toward the silliness of this predicament we're in, laughing at our foibles, laughing at our eccentricities, being willing to be wrong. Yeah. Willingness to let go. So to end, a few practical tips. You know, how might we act on some of what's been said today? A very simple way is to invoke an attitude of sincerity at the beginning of your sit. So maybe just acknowledging as you sit down on the cushion, acknowledging that what you're doing matters. Why are you doing this? Why are you sitting still on a cushion or a chair for half an hour or 45 minutes or 60 minutes? So feel the sense that you care about your inner life in some way, or you have a spiritual longing, or you just know it's beneficial, even if you can't articulate anything. That's fine. So feeling your sincerity that it makes a difference to sit. And maybe sometimes that simple sincerity or respect will open into a bigger perspective of having a sense of the lineage that brought this teaching to us and that we're participating in at that very moment of sitting. You know, we don't take ourselves so seriously sometimes. We think, oh yeah, you know, Buddhism and these ancient wisdom texts and the Insight Meditation Center and all that, but I'm just a person who sits a little bit sometimes. No, you're participating in something big, something that's been going on for 2,600 years. And you know, the Dharma is vast and profound, and it's amazing that we found it. Think of all the people who didn't find it, or think of all the other things you could have found, some of which are great, some of which might be just as good, who knows. But you found this, and it's quite good. So there can be a sense of being part of something larger. So we can practice skillful reverence. We can practice skillful irreverence. Maybe we'd even get to the point of being willing to throw dirt on our altar if we felt that we were getting attached to it in some way. But first you have to have the altar and be revering it. Then you'll learn how to lighten up on that. So, reverence and irreverence. You know, which one might need more work? Which ones are skillful, which are unskillful? There's some ground to play with there, and I hope all of you might find something amid all of that that connects for you. So these are my thoughts for today, and may they be of benefit. And if any of it wasn't, you can just leave it here. I'm not attached. So I think we're right at time, so we'll end. But if anyone has any questions, I'll stay here for a few minutes. Thank you.